Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome. Welcome to an hour of Mind Power. But we're going to be taking that mind power to a different level today. Travis Waters is my guest. His book that he has put together is called The West Coast Kid. Now, this is a story about a man's journey, and it's a journey that I don't think many of us, any of us, if we were wise, would ever want to undertake. So his candor is quite important. And one of the facts that I want to bring out right at the beginning, this is about the drug world. And more importantly, about a man who, at a very young age, got involved with it and eventually was able to get his way out of it. The journey isn't a pretty one, but it is filled with all kinds of points of information that makes us aware of a lot that we typically never hear about. And you can watch all the television shows you want, but nothing's better than the real person talking about the real experience. I want to welcome to the air Travis Waters. Travis, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Donna. Thanks for having me.
Travis, the story of the world of drugs, people watch pictures, you know, moving experiences, the drama, the dramatics. And in our world today, we've disassociated with a lot of the ugly realities, unless we've had a loved one that's involved with it, and we've seen the damages that have occurred. We're told by people that, and I've interviewed some on my show, that are involved in the drug enforcement environment, we're losing the war. We're not winning this war. We're losing the war. You got involved with the drug world when you were 14 years old. Would you give us a little bit of a background on you and how it was you entered into what I call the darker side of life, and why? Why did you need to do it? Because your mom was trying to talk you out of it.
I, like all a lot of kids in the country, I thought it was cool. I seen older people with money, bags full of money, cars, girls, beautiful girls, toys, and I wanted that lifestyle. You know, I started cleaning boats when I was 14 years old. Loads of pot would come in the Southwest Florida, and I would clean the boats, and that's how I got involved with it, and it influenced me. I just started getting into it and wanted that lifestyle. I was influenced, like all kids are.
Well, when you say that, you're a very intelligent individual. There are people that have come to me through the years that have asked a question. What do you think is more important, the person's personality, the environment that they grow up in, or the environment that they have access to? You grew up in an environment, you had a mom that was very caring. She was very much aware of this darker side of life because of her background. And you were born in North Carolina. And I know in your book, in chapter one, you said your first home was located on Prison Camp Road, named for the chain gang prison that was about a mile up the road.
Right.
Your dad was an alcoholic. Your mom moved to an area in Florida because there were people that she was talking to that said, this is where you need to have your kids. This is where you need to go. And it would just be fabulous, and that was Naples, Florida. So you move. You went into a trailer park. And your mom really wanted the best for the family. What happened to your dad? And what happened with your mom after she moved to Naples?
my dad, he eventually kept doing his, kept drinking like he has, kept doing that like he started from North Carolina, carried that with him to Naples. He continually started beating her, as always. And she eventually couldn't take it any longer and was advised to shoot him and get a gun, and it would be self-defense. And that's what she did. She shot him 6 times to end all the abuse and protect her and her kids. And then he was ordered to leave the state of Florida once he survived the shootings, and he was ordered to leave the state of Florida.
Now, let me ask you a question, going back to the questions that were asked me. When you look at what you got involved with, do you feel that the environment of your home, the abusiveness by your dad towards your mom, the action that your mother took, which the sheriff in the area didn't even, nobody was going to prosecute. Everybody knew what was happening to her.
Right.
And they said, you've got to stand up against this man. You must defend yourself, which she did. Did this influence you?
I don't, I've been asked that. I don't think that influenced me to get into the drug business. What influenced me was seeing all the money and the toys and me throwing away my scholarships. I think I had a lot of revenge. The best thing about that was the beatings that came out of that positive was me playing sports. That took me away from that nightmare. And that's how I became a sports star because of that.
Very important because you were doing fabulously. Absolutely fabulously. Now, we have situations that come up all the time where people look at teenagers and look at them as if they're still 5 or 6 years old. You purposefully made the choice. You knew the difference. You knew what your mom told you. You knew about different things. You had this wonderful opportunity in school to do scholarships and everything else. And you made a deliberate choice to go into this world that seemed to be just absolutely awesome. Have you ever said to yourself, I blame so-and-so for this?
No, that's an easy way out. I didn't want to do that. I blame myself because of, you're like any other kid. And I go back to that one question you asked me. It was environment access. It was the environment I was in. I missed too many days of school to graduate, and I was upset and mad, and I was going to have money one way or the other. And I threw away all my dreams, high school dreams, going to college. I wanted to play pro ball, and I just threw it all away for drugs, threw every bit of it away for drugs. And I blame myself for that. I can't sit here and point the finger at everybody else that was doing it before me and influenced me. I was just influenced, but no, I can't blame them. They didn't make me bring in those loads. They didn't make me get in that truck and drive 500 kilos of coke across the interstates. They didn't do that. I just did it myself. I was mad at the world. I thought I was going to take over the world after a while. I had revenge. I was trying to get them back. I don't know who I was getting back to this day. I don't know who they were. I always tell myself that, a lot of kids that get angered about it. They're getting somebody back. Who was I getting back? The only person I was getting back was myself, hurting myself and my family.
Now, at 14...
I tell that a lot when I speak in schools and stuff.
And I think that's important. I really think that's important because self-responsibility, personal responsibility, is something we need to acknowledge. And we need to acknowledge that young people are responsible. They can think.
Yes.
Now, maybe you weren't thinking, and our observation, looking from the outside in, we go, why in the world? It's just not logical. But you made the choice, and that is an important key. Now, you really got into it. You were making phenomenal sums of money. You were running these drugs for a group. What was the average amount of money you were making? I mean, you're 14, 15, 16 years old. You're making more money than most people earn in a lifetime.
I was making, before I was smuggling, I started doing running cocaine business up north from Florida to North Carolina, Ohio, and Tennessee. I was 18, 19 years old doing that, also making $50,000 to $75,000 a month off of that. And then I started smuggling drugs. I thought that was going to be a hobby because I thought that, you know, my older friends were doing that, and I thought it was cool, and I wanted more money. Once you get in, you start getting addicted to the money, and you start bringing in millions of dollars worth of loads of pot, and you're a contractor, you get paid to do it, so much to bring it in, and they would hire us to do it. And I was 18 when I brought my first, between 18 and 19 years old, when I brought my first 10,000-pound load in, wearing those night vision goggles at night, sneaking the drugs into the country from Colombia into the United States. I was hooked. The rush of it, I was addicted to it. And I never looked back.
Incredible. When did it start crashing down?
October 12th, 1989, I think it was, I got indicted for cocaine trafficking. And then 1990, I got indicted for importation of marijuana into the country. They were watching my group and me for about 3 or 4 years. And they wanted to take down the cartels in Colombia, and we were the first steps to getting the gangs in Miami and getting the cartels. And Pablo Escobar is who they were wanting the most of all, was them. Yep.
So you're busted. Now, there was a fellow, Ruben, where you had expressed to him, I'm more worried about this drug agency called the Blue Thunder Strike Force than the DEA, the U.S. Customs, or the Coast Guard. Who is the Blue Thunder Strike?
The Blue Force? Thunder was a drug task force on the water that had the fast, powerful boats that could chase our speed boats, our go-fast boats, through the waters, and they were always out there after us. And they were the ones I was the most feared of, because they were on to us. They had the equipment, the technology, and the boats to catch us. And
now,
they were one of the ones that took down our load that we got indicted on. Started it.
When this happened, you ended up going to prison. Now, your story about what you went through in the various prisons, how many prisons total were you in?
About 18, 16 to 18, I think it is, prisons and county jails, being transferred from federal.
18.
I did federal prison and state prison. I did both.
Now, how many years of your life did that take?
All my 30s. I did 6 years. I served 6 years and 10 days, but I spent most of my 30s in courts and trials and in prison. Yep.
Now,
all my 20s.
I was
30 when I got out.
So you were 30 when you got out.
Yeah.
How old were you when they tagged you? When they actually arrested you?
20, 21. Like
that. So you had 10 years of a life patterning that put you into the darkest, ugliest environment that anyone could ever be in. I'm sure there's even worse in different parts of the world.
Right.
But for you, and you go into a lot of detail in this and of this in your book, which I think is
I did that
important.
For kids so they could see.
Mm-hmm. And I think that is really what important, because there is this myth that so often is perpetuated by people that have never ever been in police work or have never ever had anyone in their family or their associations that have been incarcerated. They don't know what goes on in a lot of these places. And they are really, putting it bluntly, hellholes, because you have these personalities here that are just beyond imagining. The average person just doesn't have a clue. We hear about something on the news every once in a while, but they don't realize what's there. And it's often the ugliest dregs of human character and personality. Am I wrong?
No, you're absolutely right. And the reason I wrote it like that is because after one of my beatings, I couldn't breathe. I was laying on my bed. I couldn't breathe or cough after one of my beatings. And I said, if I make it out of here alive, I'm going to do everything I can to let the kids know what's going to happen to them in reality. I'm going to write down the emotions you're going to go through, the smells, the way you feel, the loneliness and being in here, and the sexual assaults, what you see. They have to know. I didn't sugarcoat it. It's not Disney World. And
that is true.
The most positive part about my life, even though how tragic that was. I got my punishment, I can guarantee you that. I got my punishment way more than I ever could imagine. But I wrote that book with all those emotions and smells so they could. A lot of people tell me they feel like they were in the jail with me the way I wrote that book. And that's why I
Absolutely.
Wanted it like that, so kids could feel what it was like, see what it's like, and they can't say they weren't warned when they're laying in that bed beaten and sexually assaulted and can't breathe. That they can't say they weren't warned. And I couldn't clean the book up all the way, because if you want to get it across to kids, the reality of what's going to happen to a young kid that has any kind of sports talent goes to prison, and what's going to happen to them in there, they have to see what's really going to happen to them. I can't sugarcoat it to clean it up. You know, if it's got a lot of gritty detail in it, but it should be in there for those kids to see what's going to happen to them. So maybe they think twice about it. The most positive thing about this book, I mean, writing, is all the emails and messages I get from across the country from parents and kids telling me that after they read that book, they stopped hanging around kids doing drugs. They back in school playing sports, making straight A's and B's, and parents thanking me. I hear so many stories of that, and that's the most positive thing that's come out of that tragedy for me is how this book's – I was never amazed of how many people this book's helped. You know, I'm really amazed at my story.
One of the comments
so many people.
Yeah, that you made in the book is that you knew you were going to get caught. You knew you
yep.
were going to get caught. And you knew you
yep.
were going to go to prison, but it didn't stop. You just knew it was a matter of time. It's almost like subconsciously you really
yep,
did want to get caught. You really wanted to get out of it, but you didn't want – there were the different sides to you. Your mother –
Yes.
just had begged you over and over and over and over again. And it just saddened her deeply, because she had such pride in you and knew that you could have had a much different life. And there's conversations that you have in your book about your mom and how she still tried to communicate with you.
Yep.
And when you finally went through all of this, and you were able to get out of prison, and you had a chance to talk with her, what was it like for you to be with your mother, who had tried so hard to help you see the negative thing you were going through?
I just told her that I loved her, and I'm sorry. I let a lot of people down, her, myself, my coaches. A lot of people depended on me. A lot of people had faith in me to go on to play college ball and hopefully play pro ball one day. I let everybody down. I came home. I went back to my original bedroom, and I went in there and looked up at the vent where I used to keep a lot of money and the closets where I used to keep a lot of cash money. And I sat on my bed, opened up my scrapbook from high school, and started crying. That was it.
Mm-hmm.
My mom came in the room and says, don't you wish you would have listened to me now? I said, yes. She never knew about the sexual assaults. I never told her any of that, because she was always worried about me getting raped and killed in there anyway. And all that stuff was happening to me. She didn't know about the rapings and the sexual assaults. She just knew about when I was almost killed the time in Rayford, when I was in the public hospital and stuff and almost died, because she come up to see me there and didn't know what happened to me.
Now,
so it's
you came
I
out of prison. You're 30 years old.
Right.
You've got to build a life. What did you do?
I started working for my father, his big company down here in Naples, Florida. And then I started my own companies, my lawn service and landscaping company and stuff like that. And some articles started coming out about me about playing sports when I took my son to a basketball camp, and that's how the book started. I had a lot of publishing companies calling me, wanting me to write a tell-all book. And I made a promise to myself that if I ever made out alive, I would do everything I could to help these kids, and I did. And I wrote that book. Yep. That was my therapy. For that, when I
now,
wrote that
your
book,
nickname.
I never had any therapy.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and it probably was a very liberating therapy.
It was.
The West
I was
Coast
released.
Kid is the title you chose, because that was your name when you were in this dark world.
Right.
And
that was the name. Yep.
That was your name. Now, you come out, you decide that you really want to make a difference. You want to work with young kids. You want
yes.
to help them out. What
it's always been a dream.
Up, Mm-hmm. What opened up the door for you? Because usually when someone finds out about a person's prison background, you're a felon, a lot of your rights were taken away. You make a statement in your book, you were the property of the state.
Yep.
And here you are, you come out. What was the shift? What enabled you to step up to the plate? And how were people open to you working with their kids after what you had been through?
Well, I just applied to be a coach, and I was granted the opportunity to coach youth basketball. And then I started doing that, and the parents knew about my story, and they read me, and a lot of articles came out about me in the newspapers, and they took a chance on me, and I was a dream of mine to always do that, and I'm able to give back. I sponsor a bunch of teams, I coach, and I'm very excited about it. And it's a dream come true. When you read that book, parts in that book, I said, if I ever make out here alive, I'd love to do that. And happened. And I do. My rights are gone. I still can't vote. Everything, you know, can't hunt if you wanted to hunt. You know, that's what I tell kids too. All your rights are taken from you. I still have nightmares of the past that never goes away. You're still punished, even though you're free. You're still punished when you. There's no positive comes from drugs. No positive will ever come from drugs.
And you mentioned in your book how the people that knew of you, even today, still try to contact you to see if you will come back into the fold.
Yes, when I first got out, they did that. Yes, they sure did. More people you meet, other connections you meet in prisons and stuff like that, kids are going to go through that too. You go in there, you have more connections in there than when you're on the streets. That all that is a breeding ground for more crime.
Yeah.
When you're in prison. Yes.
You say that you can't change the past, which is true.
Can't change.
No matter how hard you try, it's there. But you've leveraged this. You said, I'm going to make my life mean something. For all of what I didn't do right, I want to mean something. And again, that's how the book came about. You have a wonderful family. You've got a lovely wife, wonderful children. And for you, you were even able to reconnect with your former coach, Coach Stewart.
Yep.
And that, when you shared your story with him, did he want you to speak to the kids that he works with?
Yeah, I do a lot of speaking. My book, that high school is actually the first book that my book officially went into the library, was my former high school, and then from there it took off. Most read book, most popular book in schools down here in South Florida, and I do speak there a lot. Yes, and he's behind me 100%. I can never forgive myself for letting him down the way I did, and him coming out and calling me the school's first great player when I first came home. I read that in the papers. I cried for over a week. I cried for over a week because it just emphasized to me how much more I threw my life away.
Mm-hmm. But here you are, you're around young people, you're saying don't do as I have done.
Right.
Do what is right for you right now. Do what I am doing now with my life. But understand, this is the result of a lot of pain and suffering, and like you say in your book, your rights, many of your rights as a citizen of the United States are gone for the rest of your life. You're never going to get them back. And those experiences still haunt you. When people see the romanticizing of this, which I often see in various television programs that I observe, and I go, how do you get past this? How can you really reach the mind of a young person and make them aware that they need to know this is not Hollywood stuff. This isn't the real world. What you've got here is something so vile that it will totally destroy your life. Do you find that the kids that you're around, that they just blow off what you say? Do they think, I saw this on this program or that program?
I tell them there's no guarantee in life. I can tell them, I could preach to them till they're blue in the face, but I sit down with them. I don't usually stand up and speak. I sit down with them. I interact with them. I do Q&As with them on the book. I let them know I'm one of them because I used to be one of them. And there is no guarantee. They do listen to me. I had, like I told you before, I had so many emails and from around the country, and parents coming up to me and kids sending me messages that they turn their life around after they read my book. They don't want anything to do with drugs. And so I know my story is working. I from, you know, saving so many already, and it's just that's what I continue. I want my book in every high school, every drug treatment center, juvenile detention center. I'm just now in the crime prevention programs here in South Florida. That's a new thing that we're doing. And I donate a lot of books to places, especially places that unfortunate to be able to afford the books for their centers and stuff like that. Yes, I get.
There is a major problem, not just in this country, but around the world. These drug cartels, these different organizations, they are doing a business which destroys the lives of others, and they laugh at us that are on the sidelines saying, this is terrible stuff. When we hear stories of officers in the drug enforcement area, they say, we're losing the war. We've put billions and billions of dollars into it. We're losing the war. How would you say that we need to approach this? You've been on both sides of the fence. In your personal evaluation of this, what do you think can be done?
Well, first of all, I think that they've made great strides into helping the interdiction of drugs coming into the country with more technology. They are doing that, but when there's a demand, there's always going to be a supply. Another focus is the main problems that we're having here in the United States that I see from talking to these centers and kids and schools is right here in our own backyard in the medicine cabinets. That's one of the biggest problems too that's destroying these young lives is all the pills they have here in our own country and getting into the parents' medicine cabinets. Like I live here in South Florida, and over in Lauderdale and West Palm Beach is like the major hub of pill capital of the country. Was here in the west coast of Florida or east coast of Florida.
My goodness.
And they're finally cutting down on that now, and arresting a lot of these doctors, giving out all these prescriptions from people coming from up north. So they're making big strides in that, cutting down a lot of these called pill mills down here in Florida. Yes. So that's my theory on that. That's where a lot of the problem lies, too, is right here in their own medicine cabinets, in their own backyards.
In our own backyard. So what would you say to people that are listening, to the moms and dads, the grandmothers, grandfathers, aunts and uncles, friends, to anyone that is concerned about this? Because so many people are on medication. The pharmaceutical industry is producing this. They're making billions of dollars on these
medications. Billions of dollars.
And this is something, like you said, it's in our own medicine cabinets. What would you say to those people listening today? What would you want them to be aware of relative to medicines?
The first thing I would do is lock up the medicine cabinets at every house. Lock up all the medicine cabinets at everybody's household.
Mm-hmm.
And look for signs. Look for signs of the kids missing school, dropping out of school, not doing their regular routines. There's something going on. That's for sure.
Travis, your book, West Coast Kid, I think is one of the most powerful publications I have come across in a long while dealing with the drug issue. You don't have any romance or woo-woo in it at all. You're down right there with honesty, and your integrity in putting out the details is incredible. And I think it is fabulous. I'm really glad you've done it, and I'm sorry that you had to go through such a path. Yet maybe this is something that by your having lived it, you're able to communicate more effectively with the younger generation. And I think that they can hear it from you and know that when you speak and you speak from your heart and just give the facts as they are, it's terrifying to them. It really shakes them up because they can't scam you. They can't say, oh, gee whiz, you just don't understand, you're an older person, blah, blah, blah. No way. You've been there. You've been in the hellhole. You managed to get out. It consumed the youth part of your life in a phenomenal way. But again, you decided you were going to do something with it. You decided you were going to try to make this world a better place because of your experience. Now, I know people can go to your website, and it's the title of your book, westcoastkid.com. And I know they're going to find on there all kinds of information about you, the programs that you're a part of. And I would say to any of you listening, heed what he said about the medicine products in your home, in the environment maybe some of the elder members of your family might be in. If there are young people around, this is a book that you may want to pass along to them. Maybe buy the book. Put it in your local school library. Put it in places where people will be able to know that they can pass it along to a young person. Because if we can do this for those that are beginning to touch the cusp of adulthood, making them aware that the so-called world of the big money and the thrills of doing something and or becoming addicted to the very substances that they're trafficking can end up being beyond belief. And I'm not talking about positive belief either. The West Coast Kid, my redemption, is what Travis Waters says. I think that the book is that redemption, and that redemption is saving the lives and the world of possibility that would disappear otherwise for a lot of young people, maybe even some adults as well. Travis, thank you so much for being my guest today. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
It's been a delight.
Spread the message.
Thank you. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break for just a moment. Check out West Coast Kid. I'm telling you, it's a read unlike any other read you will ever have. Donna Sebo here. We'll take a break. We're going to be back in just a moment.
Do you have children between the ages of 3 to 10? Do you love children's books and collect them? Then you'll want to know about God's Kiss, the award-winning illustrated children's book that has been enjoyed by families around the world. 15 beautiful illustrations by Pacific Northwest artist Ed Gedrose accompany this lovely story about a little boy named Johnny that will capture your heart and mind in a very special way. Multicultural and non-denominational in content, it will become a family favorite that you and your children will want to read again and again. This book is available by itself through Amazon, or if you contact me, Donna Sebo, directly, you can get a personalized signed copy. There is also a talking book. You can order the talking book CD by contacting me via email, donna@delphiinternational.com, or by calling 253-582-5604. You can also visit my website, delphiinternational.com, to see more details. God's Kiss is a family classic that belongs in everyone's library. Get your copy now.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. I'm so delighted that you're sharing this time with me today. Telephone number if you'd like to call in and chat with me. I'd be delighted to turn the light on in your life with a little bit of insight. So give me a buzz at 888-627-6008. Quickly, I do want to mention for those of you up in Alaska, I will be setting my time. I'm going to be going up to Fairbanks and to Anchorage for radio shows and appearances there, and I will be letting you know within a short period of time, probably by the end of the week, what my schedule is going to be. So that will be coming out. Also, I want to let you know tomorrow we're going to be talking about money. If you're in business, if you've had to deal with being an entrepreneur, if you want to know how to be profitable, well, Ruth King is my guest. We're going to be finding out about this and how to understand to become profitable, not go into the red all the time. Well, Ruth has got some real good basic business pizzazz, but I think it's always good to be reminded of this, especially if you're thinking of becoming an entrepreneur. Advice is for winners. Raul Valdez Perez. Boy, is this a powerful book. Have you ever been in a moment where you go, what do I do? Gee, how can I take care of a situation? Have you ever felt like you didn't even know the right questions to ask? Let me tell you, Raul has put together a book that is a real eye-opener. He actually gives you some tools so that if you're feeling like you are just going nowhere and your brain is like in a fog about what to do, how to do it, This book is excellently done. And I'll just say we're going to be sharing a lot of those points of suggestion and information on Friday. Remember, you can always go in to the bbsradio.com website, Station 1, The Donna Sebo Show, tap on show information, and you'll find out the details about the guests that are upcoming if you're interested in that. So that is our lineup for today. For the coming week, give me a call if you'd like to chat again. It's 888-627-6008. The mind is a powerful instrument, and life always is going to have its twists and its turns. Nobody is exempt from them. Sometimes we might be in a situation we don't like, and we want to get out of it. We really, really want to get out of it, but we don't know how life can possibly flow our way, bringing us what it is that we desire. Well, I wanted to share a story with you about a woman by the name of Ginger. Ginger lives in Illinois. Her husband had lost his job. And this was a woman, or is, not was, is a woman of deep faith. And she really wanted to move from the rundown house that she and her family were living in. Okay, the economy stinks. Her husband has lost his job. They are at a very, very low level financially. They have an 8-year-old son. The place they were living in, dark, cramped, floors, bad condition. It's cold. The appliances that were in their apartment, always breaking down. It was filthy, the bathroom that they had to share. They lived in an apartment complex where they had to share the bathroom with someone else, and it was just appalling. It was really dirty. There was nothing else in the area that they were located in that they could afford. And then one day, cheese finds, rat, mice dropping, cockroaches are running all over everything. She'd had it. She really had it. She put out a call to the universe, a prayer, if you will. She said, I have been asking for a new location for us to go to. Where is it? Well, she was just in the right state of mind, and the timing was right. And there was like an inner voice that said to her, turn here and go up 2 blocks. She said it popped into her head so strongly that she didn't question it. She had nothing to lose, so she turned, walked the 2 blocks, and at the end of the second block, the same impression, voice impression, came to her and said, turn right and go up 3 more blocks. She did it. She finds herself standing in front of a house. The voice says, walk up to the door and ask about the apartment. She was stunned. She didn't see a for rent sign. But what did she have to lose? She walks up to the front door. A young woman answers the door. And what did she do? She asked a question. Do you know where I can find an apartment for rent? Well, the woman that answered the door, her eyes just got amazingly large. She said, how did you know? We haven't even listed it yet. Well, this woman was joined by her husband, who happened to be home. And her husband said, who's at the door? And she says, well, someone who's interested in the apartment. The man was really surprised. They had not put it up. They were getting ready to put a listing out, but they had not put it up yet. The man said, hey, we'll show it to her anyway. When she stepped in to the apartment, everything was sparkling clean. There was wonderful light that was coming in through the windows. Everything was fabulous. There was a lot of storage room. It was everything that she wanted. Well, of course, there's the next question. How much is the apartment? How much is the rent? This is what happened. The husband of the woman that answered the door turned around and asked her a question. How much can you afford? she told him. He said, that'll do. It was amazing. Her husband, his name is Ricardo, he said, what? How did you find this place? Well, she told him. She told him about everything. She told him how she had been meditating and asking for a place that they could move to. She was very specific in what she wanted. But then he really smiled when she added one other thing. She said, I ended up getting more than I asked for. This apartment even has a balcony. I wanted to share that story with you because I wanted to say that sometimes life, the universe, whatever term you want to use, brings something to us we never in a million years could even imagine. Not only does it bring it to us, but it surpasses our expectations. But like Ginger, sometimes we have to really be specific, and we have to just know, not just know that we can have it, but also accept the information that's given to us about where to go and what to do. Sometimes it comes about in the most unusual ways. And it's happened often enough in my life that all I can say is that I felt compelled to share this story with you because you need to know we've got a lot of options to work with in life. And it's so easy to get stuck in the gunk. And sometimes we think that we're in a bad space. But think of my guest that I had on today. He entered into a series of life experiences that were hideous. He thought it was pretty cool. He got what he wanted. But then he saw the results. And he knew what was going to happen to him. But he did it anyway. How did he make something that was bad into something good? By changing his mind, changing his actions, by making a point of choice with his eyes, mind, heart, soul and spirit wide open and aware. And that is what we all can do. I think he's an excellent example of demonstrating how we can take something that seemingly is very ugly and an extreme spectrum and turn it into something positive. I find that there's a rhythm to life that is amazing, and I'm in awe of it every day. Whether it's watching a hummingbird out doing its thing, observing how Mother Nature can find a way to grow even in the ugliest of circumstances, or hearing someone's story like the one we shared today. Life is full of amazing patterning, and you need to know that wherever you are right now in this moment, you have choice. That choice is yours to exercise, and it is through being awake, aware, and mindful, being alert to the possibilities, not slamming the door on them, not getting locked up into emptiness and saying there are no options. Instead, taking what you have and figuring out how you can leverage it and start asking questions and reaching out. It makes all the difference in the world. This is Donna Sebo. When we come back, I've got some other good things to share with you, including a real interesting chip and dip. I would never have thought of doing this, but someone did, and it's quick, easy, and different. And I can guarantee you just about everybody will enjoy it. It'll surprise you, I think. Chip and dip, a different way. We'll be talking about that and so many other things in just a moment. Donna Sebo here. We're taking a break. Don't forget you can give me a buzz at 888-627-6008. We'll be right back.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. I mentioned to you this chip and dip solution, and I'll tell you, it really was something when I came across it. I said, oh, this is great. Teenagers would love it. It's just so easy to fix. Salami chips with a grainy mustard dip. And this is a woman, her name is Linda Schrake. She's in New York. And this is so easy. And boy, I'm telling you, people really like this. This is good. This is what you need. You need 1/4 cup of sour cream, 1/4 cup of top quality mayonnaise, 2 tablespoons of Dijon mustard, 2 tablespoons of grainy mustard, and 8 ounces of thinly sliced salami. Now again, sour cream, mayonnaise, 1/4 cup of each, Dijon mustard, grainy mustard, 2 tablespoons each of that, and then 8 ounces of thinly sliced salami. All you do is mix together your sour cream, your mayonnaise, your Dijon mustard, grainy mustard, and a small bowl. Refrigerate it. It's a good idea to make it up in advance so that the flavors marry nicely, and maybe 2 hours for that. Then, before you get ready to serve the chips, you're going to need to preheat your oven to about 375 degrees. You want to line 2 baking sheets with parchment paper. You could even use silicone baking mats, but the parchment paper I love. I use it in so many baking processes because it just absorbs. You pitch it, you throw it away. It's just really great. And what you do, you have your oven racks at the centermost position, and you put your salami slices out in a single layer on the baking sheets, and you bake them until they're evenly browned, again at 375, for about 10 to 12 minutes. And they're going to get oily because all of the fat from the salami is going to come out. But then what you do when you bake them, then you just transfer them to some paper towels, and that grease will just blot off on the paper towels, and they are going to crisp even more as they cool. Serve them with the dip. Boy, these are great, great munchies, really good munchies. A lot of the fat will go out of it, but it's that salty combination with the salami that's just absolutely wonderful. And, of course, the salami needs to be wafer thin, and you can buy it in the store already sliced. But if you like to do your own salami, then make sure that you slice it exceedingly thin. Because, again, they're going to dry. They're going to get that real chip-like crispness to it after you bake them. And if you want, you can use your fat-free mayonnaise and or sour cream and try it. Just see how it tastes to you. You may find that there's not very much difference in the taste in the dip. So just something so easy, so quick, so fast, and different. Instead of your regular chips and dip, this is one that has a flavor to it. And I'd say if you want to make it a little spicier, consider adding a little hot sauce to it or using a spicier mustard if you want. Experiment. Have fun. That's what recipes are all about. Recipes are meant to be enjoyed, fun to do, and I think it's a great way to get people together. If you say, I have a new cookie recipe or I have this recipe, you want to come over for a taste test? What a great way to socialize with people, too. People are always willing, especially when it comes to the sweet things, to be an enterprising participant so that they can critique what you do. I remember one lady, she wrote a brownie cookbook, and I interviewed her, and she was so much fun. And her husband worked for a fire department, and so she would say, guys, I have a new recipe. You want to be taste testers? And they'd be right there. They'd say, we'll be happy to do that for you. And she said it was so much fun because they critiqued. And She got some recipes that were just absolutely amazing, like cream de menthe fudge brownies and all kinds of things. And they just said, this passes our approval, but we'll criticize this. And sometimes she had to say, all right, guys, are you really giving me the straight scoop? Because they say, are you still going to bring us brownies? So she had to be sure she got the real scoop from them sometimes. But they had a lot of fun doing it, and she had a lot of fun practicing. And sometimes things didn't turn out so well, and they'd let her know about that in no uncertain terms. But anyway, I just thought I'd share those few thoughts with you. Ponzi schemes. Haven't we all heard about that? The most recent one that was the biggest, in fact. It's just absolutely, unbelievably huge. I don't even think that they know all of the real numbers. Bernie Madoff. Yes, we can all relate. Sadly, I have some friends that, believe it or not, were affected by this. A lot of people were. This man caused so much devastation in the lives of so many people. How does a Ponzi scheme work? Well, it's a fraudulent investment operation that will pay returns to separate investors from their own money, or money that is paid by subsequent investors rather than from any actual profit earned. And a schemer will start out doing something very simply. They'll maybe take, let's say, $100 from investors, promising to double it within a month. But instead of investing their money, the individual who is doing the Ponzi scheme pays them with funds from larger successive rounds of investors. And it just keeps growing and growing and growing and growing. Now, what's our earliest record that we're aware of with Ponzi schemes? They've been around as long as there's been money. Well, one of the earliest ones was a William F. Miller, and this was in the United States in 1899. But the scheme itself didn't really get its name, the Ponzi scheme, until 1920. Now, with Mr. Miller in 1899, in modern-day dollars, what he skimmed off was about $25 million. Ponzi in 1920 got $130 million. Then there was a fellow in Sweden, Ivar Kruger, who ended up in 1930 skimming the equivalent today of $1.5 billion. 1970, there was a Dona Branca in Portugal. She skimmed, in modern-day dollars, $600 million and really was, you know, quite accomplished at it. In 1986, Diamond Mortgage, here in the United States, $100 million. Romania, the Caritas Company, 1992, $1.5 billion. 1994, the MM Company in Russia, $2 billion. And of course, we all know about good old Bernie. In 2008, his was $65 billion. You're hearing me correctly, $1 billion that he stole. $65 billion. That would go a big way towards helping the deficit, wouldn't it? Anyway, I just thought I'd share that information with you. So just remember, there is an old adage that says if it's too good to be true, it's too good to be true. Check it out. I recall some friends that tried to get us to invest many years ago into something they thought was just terrific. It sometimes can be called a pyramid scheme, Ponzi scheme, however you want to term it. Boy, that was something my husband and I both realized. It was too good to be true. Couldn't possibly bring the return. So remember, common sense can go a long way. But more than anything else, I want to bring home the point, like our guest did today. Don't be afraid to speak your truth. Don't be afraid to share your experiences in life, because it may help someone else. Sometimes we have to make sure that they're willing to listen, but other times we just have to take a chance, like my guest, Travis Waters, did by writing his book, And he's finding that the ripple effect is really phenomenal. And you can have an effect on someone's life in a wonderful way. You make a difference. Who you are is so important. And I'm so glad you were able to join me today. I want to just say, remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Don't ever turn it over to someone else. Remember, you are the one that makes your choices. Good, bad, or indifferent, you can always expand into the greater good in a way you would never have dreamed just by being true to yourself. This is Donna Siebel. I look forward to visiting with you tomorrow. We're going to be talking how to be profitable. You have the courage for that? Well, won't you join me? Tell your friends. Talk with you tomorrow, same time, same place. This is Donna Siebel. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Siebel Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Siebel Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.